This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. My name is Rin Beeth, and I'm a host on the Human Rights Channel. Today, we have Eric Stanley here to discuss their new book, Atmospheres of Violence, Structuring Antagonism and the Transqueer Ungovernable. Eric Stanley is an associate professor in the Department of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for coming on the show, Eric.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you.
So I'm going to start with the very, very, very beginning of this book. I am a huge fan of acknowledgments. I always read them. And reading through your acknowledgments, I was really struck by the emphasis on collective work that went into the creating of this and what you call pedagogies of action. And I was wondering if we could start this conversation, if you'd be willing to speak a little bit more to how this shaped your work.
Sure. So, you know, everything that I ever do that I think is really important, I've done with other people. And I'm deeply formed by collective action, particularly, you know, street-based kind of radical trans and queer direct action organizing. So that's the scene that I come from. And, you know, oftentimes the academy and things like writing a theoretically solo authored book are incredibly antagonistic to that acknowledgement, right? That of course our work is never only ours, right? And it's always built in and with and through community. And, you know, as I talk about in the book, the materiality of my life is also only made possible through, you know, these kind of networks of care and of, you know, collective thinking that are so important to me. So, you know, whenever I have the chance, I always return to that because I think it's really important because it also, again, disrupts the idea that there's this kind of singular, really smart, really important person when, of course, that's never the case, that we're always formed in, you know, in relationality with all kinds of people.
I really like that. So moving to another part at the beginning of the book, the book itself, I think, really begins with a point about how there's a lot of violence described in this book. And you also state a kind of refusal to, quote unquote, reproduce the incident. And this refusal comes up throughout the book. And while I was reading this, it really reminded me, I'm an anthropologist, and it reminded me of Audra Simpson's idea of ethnographic refusal as she elaborates in Mohawk Interruptus. And so super short, it's a refusal that is seen as an alternative to recognition, something practiced by those in Ganawage. And she herself is a researcher who is Mohawk and from Ganawage. And so I would just be curious to hear you speak a little bit to how refusal forms both part of the book's text and also perhaps the research practice, like the process of creating this text.
Yeah, so this book took me about 15 years to write, actually, from when I first started writing it. Some of the writing I did in, you know, graduate seminars a very long time ago. And, you know, what I was doing then is I was, you know, just thinking about this question of the ever-growing archive of anti-trans and queer violence, right? And this was, you know, almost before the internet or before my accessibility to the internet. So I had a paper file where I would, like, you know, tear out things from the newspaper and from magazines of these really horrible stories, right? And I didn't know what I was going to do with them. You know, and I was like kind of layering those on top of, you know, personal experiences and the experiences of people in my community and also the organizing that we were doing at that time. You know, and this kind of archive, this really brutal archive just kept growing. And so for me, it felt really important that I attempt to theorize that kind of continually growing archive, while also, of course, not wanting to re-violate people that are always already subjected to massive forms of violence, right? So I felt in a certain sense ethically caught in a productive way, right? You know, looking and looking away are both, I would say, simultaneously forms of abstracting violence from their scenes, right? They're also forms of accumulation. You know, and so instead of, in the final instance, which is to say the book, you know, assuming that I could have some sort of, I don't know, pure space of clarity outside of the scene, I just tried to stay with it with as much care and precision as I could. You know, at some times I would be more descriptive, at other times I would back away from that, attempting to kind of always hold that line, which, you know, I myself within the text attempt to place it under duress, right? I question it. You know, almost on every page, I'm like, I'm doing this. I don't know if I should be doing this. I still don't know if I should be doing this. But nonetheless, the murders continue, the violence continues, and our kind of refusal to acknowledge the enormity and both the enormity and the pageantry, the way in which there are like the similarities in these forms of violence, you know, we're not getting out of it by not paying attention. You know, and so I think that, and I have, as I'm sure you know, at the beginning, I have this little section called Reading with Care, where, of course, I want people, you know, to be aware of what they're about to sit with, right? Because I, again, am not attempting to traumatize people or re-traumatize people, but nonetheless, you know, I think that these are, you know, this archive needs to be faced if we indeed want to obliterate it, which is what I want to do.
Throughout the book, I was really struck by your discussions about law and violence, and these discussions, these points go, you know, engage police violence, right? But it goes way beyond that. Like, you engage with legal systems and structures themselves as being part of this archive of violence. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit, I know this is quite broad, but if you could speak a little bit to how you see these links between law and violence.
Sure. So, you know, the book is, in its most basic form, an abolitionist critique of violence, right? So if we can't look towards the law as, you know, the necessary space of relief, then where do we go, right? And so to get there, you know, I start with Jacques Derrida's reading of Walter Benjamin's, you know, critique of violence, which I think in a certain sense opens up the question of the law as that which, you know, both constitutes the limit and what, you know, what counts as violence and is outside of that same constitution. And, you know, that's a theoretical point, but I think the point is made by all kinds of other theorists that are experiencing police violence, for example, right? It's the same theorization. And we see this time, you know, that's in the kind of more abstracted theoretical sense, but then we see this time and again when people, you know, seek remedy for something like police violence through the legal structure, right? You know, and it's always partial at best. And of course, what accountability might look like under that system is always a structural impossibility. You know, and this both comes from, you know, reading, you know, people that are critical of the criminal punishment system, as well as kind of organizing work that time and again shows me that the law, you know, is actually the proliferation of violence and not violence is cessation. And so then what do we do, right? What is to be done? Which is a really big question, and I don't assume that I can answer that. But what hopefully I can do is pry open that question, right? Because what we see, at least in the nightmare named the United States, is whenever, you know, a trans or a queer person is murdered, we're like, oh, we need to catch that person, that singular person, and punish them. And it's not, of course, that those people should not be held accountable, but what is the entire system that, you know, not only allows the ongoingness of this murder, but indeed mandates it? So, you know, that's a much larger question that is actually antagonistic to the law.
So building on your really provocative, and I mean that as the highest of compliments, points about law and violence, I was really struck by your engagement with the idea of democracy. I wasn't expecting it when I picked up this book a while ago, and revisiting it for our conversation today, it struck me again. And so as you write on page 116, democracy's durability is built at least in part through its mythic past, which even in ancient Athens was only mythological. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to how democracy forms a part of this, because I think for many who are not considering anti-trans, anti-queer violence in the way that you are, that link between this kind of violence and democracy might not be so clear.
Sure. Yeah, that I think probably is the most provocative part of the book. So for people that haven't read it, essentially I attempt to make a provisional argument, I guess, questioning, I'm not sure what the right word is, of the very idea of democracy, right? And I came to this point because, you know, I was writing the CODA, which is where this is, you know, during the time of Trump's election, and people were like, you know, this is not normal. This is, you know, outside of the otherwise smooth space of the democratic form. And of course, it is democracy in action, right? And at the same time, people were, you know, were arguing that the concept of democracy itself oftentimes gets left as if it's self-evident, right? And so people attach all kinds of desires onto it without understanding what its history is, right? And that history's presence, as well as understanding, you know, how it has always functioned, right? We're always attempting to perfect this thing that might already be at its limit, right? Of course, and I start in Athens because I'm working with C.L.R. James in the ways in which, you know, even in Athens, of course, enslaved people and women were outside the polis, right? The kind of idea of citizenship. And that has been, of course, through, you know, through its like kind of historical unfolding of the concept of democracy. So it was also interesting to me because, you know, we have someone like C.L.R. James, who, you know, I've learned so much from, you know, arguing for a more democratic state, and someone like George Bush or Trump also arguing for a more democratic state, right? So then what is its substance? What is its form? If everyone's like, we need more of this thing, you know, that's an interesting set of questions. And so for me, as a kind of experiment, I wanted to ask, you know, how could we take an abolitionist critique to the very idea of democracy? Of course, not towards totalitarianism or some other worse form of governance, but, you know, towards exploring what other ways of being together in the world might look like, right? And so it's not prescriptive. I don't have like a 10-point program. You know, I'm not like, we need to get rid of this, we need to do this, we need to pack the court, we need to do that, whatever. I simply want to ask the question, what is democracy? And perhaps we're already living at its limit, as I already said. And if so, then perhaps we need new forms of being together in the world, because there's many, many ones. And why is it this one that we've settled on?
Yeah, it was a really fascinating, engagement, a really fascinating question that I'm still sitting with many, many months later. And I appreciate you raising this. As a bit of a turn away from law and democracy, in chapter 3, you engage with the idea of the filmic both at a theoretical level, but bringing the readers back to the example. I guess I hesitate to say the example, but of an instance, I guess, of a police surveillance tape of a horrific beating of a Black trans woman. And I would be curious to hear you speak a little bit to how this idea of the filmic can help get at this idea of an atmosphere of violence. And I was just particularly struck by the ways that you talked about the filmic in the context of like anti-Black, anti-queer, anti-trans violence, all of those layers.
Yeah. So, you know, that chapter begins with this, as you said, this really awful, horrific and brutal videotape of Dwana Johnson being beaten by a number of police officers. And after her beating, she went on a kind of mini press tour where she wanted people to see the tape, right? So that she had some sort of like collective witnessing of what happened to her. You know, so that's an interesting place of departure because theoretically it opens up the collective viewing process because it's what the survivor wants. But nonetheless, right, all the mechanisms of the politics of looking are still there. So we think we've gotten out of it, but we're still in it. So I thought that was really important. It was also, you know, I was doing kind of some solidarity work around her case at the time. So it was like something I was organizing around as well. You know, so what happens in short, I'll try to condense the story, is that, you know, there's a really awful beating tape. It's incredibly apparent what's happening. You know, a police officer puts handcuffs on his hand and punches her in the face. It's really awful. She fights back. And I think that's really important to note. And eventually the officer goes to trial and there's a mistrial, right? So the jury watches this video where she's seated and being punched by this, you know, she's a Black trans woman, he's a white man, cis man, I'm assuming, punching this woman in the face repeatedly. And, you know, they can't reach a guilty verdict, right? And so there's something about, you know, my argument, which goes back through much, you know, Black visual culture theory, and thinking with people like David Marriott and many other people. And again, back to the Rodney King tape, where a lot of this kind of initial theorization, at least in the US context, was coming from, and then much older work as well. You know, and instead of just thinking about what we're seeing, like what the actual picture is, I was interested in what, you know, going back to the question of form, essentially, which, you know, sometimes drops out of, you know, our understanding of things like police beating tapes, right? And so, you know, again, working with, you know, feminists and Black visual culture theorists, you know, I return to this question, like, is there something in the form of the visual itself that is indeed anti-Black and anti-trans, right? So that these viewers could view that tape and actually see the officer as the person that was under duress and not the woman that's seated and being beaten by a group of men. Right? Because that's the question that I think is important. Like, how is it that they literally can see the tape while not seeing what's happening? Right? And we could, of course, excuse it by kind of individualistic, you know, anti-Black and anti-trans phobias or antagonisms. And I'm sure that's part of it. But I think that there's something much larger. And indeed, that's much more terrifying. Right? Because I'm always trying to de-individualize things because I think that that allows us these really easy answers that actually continue harm and don't end the harm, right? Because we're like, oh, those were just some bad jurors. We need the right jurors in here, right? We need a kind of representative jury, but then the representative jury finds the same. So it just keeps going on and on and on, right? Which grows the legal system. And so, you know, for me, the question of the visual and in particular, the filmic, right, the idea of the moving image, or at least the digital, or in this case, the digital image, you know, this was an attempt to think on the level of form around things that we oftentimes only analyze at the level of image, right? We're seeing this woman being beaten by this man, but what is about the filmic itself that actually has that kind of built-in precondition of our ways of seeing?
I have a follow-up question about that video and the way that you engage with it in the chapter. There's a point when you're talking about the circulation of the video of the beating of Dawana Johnson. And I was just, I was so struck, and like, I can feel myself tearing up now because it was just like, it just really hit me. This question that you ask of how then might we account for, or more precisely, how might we be accountable to Dawana Johnson as we consume her image? And I'm wondering, how does this idea of accountability figure in both your approach to this material or of these ideas or instances of violence, as well as in the questions that you're asking the reader, the questions that you're giving us to sit with?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, right, I mean, like we started talking about, of course, viewing, reading, they're always consumptive processes, right? So what would it mean to make ourselves kind of radically vulnerable to that reality versus hiding it, which is what the entire academic enterprise is based off of? And so, you know, and, you know, I think in a certain sense, that's a necessarily unanswerable question, right? The only way that we could be accountable to Dawana Johnson is by destroying the world which destroyed her. And, you know, that's a really big project, but a project that I think that we all need to be involved in, right? Because, you know, she actually was, a few months after the beating tape, murdered. And there's lots of speculation that it was done by perhaps somebody from the police department because the way that it was done. And so then she could not testify against the person that beat her. And so I think that, you know, the question of accountability, especially to those that are already gone, right? Those that are already lost to the world, you know, is a question that we must allow ourselves to be haunted by, right? And that's, you know, and again, that's a place of departure. And I think that that's on the kind of more theoretical level. But then I also think that, you know, this book is always trying to, like, it's working at this kind of meta theoretical level, but then it also is incredibly, like, grounded in the world. And I think that those are, like, the areas I'm always shuttling through. You know, but it can also look like organizing towards abolition, right? Getting rid of the Memphis Police Department would be one way to do justice for Dawana Johnson, right? It could look like sending books to people inside prison jails and detention centers and psych jails, right? Which is, you know, my very small author profits from this book go to that, right? And the same with captive genders and other things, right? Because it's like the least I can do. While also continuing all of us to engage in organizing work, right? There's so much to be done, and there's ways for all of us to plug in, whatever our kind of level of accessibility is, right? There's always things to be done, and there's space for all of us to be doing them. And so, you know, in the same way that the image doesn't begin or end with the tape, the story and its narration doesn't end with the book, right? And so what would it mean for a book to have an afterlife that, of course, inspires action? And all the books that I love do that for me. And so I'm hoping that this, you know, people are always like, well, you know, what can this book do? And I'm like, I don't actually know, you know, maybe nothing. Maybe you could, like, throw it through a window. I don't know. But, you know, at best, hopefully it can be, you know, following people like Ruth Wilson Gilmore, you know, theory can be a kind of plan towards action. And so I hope that this can do something like that, but I don't know.
I was, I mean, just broadly, I was struck by the engagement with the visual throughout this book. It was really, it left me with a lot to think through. I was additionally really struck by, the fourth chapter, about suicide. And I was hoping you could perhaps speak a little bit about, I guess maybe a different way of framing a question I haven't asked yet is the idea of the death drop. I found a really, I don't know, like, very visceral metaphor in so many different ways. There's so many levels in which you engaged with it. And so I don't know, I'd never read writing about trans queer suicide in this way that dealt with it and the performance of the deaf. Anyway, I would love to hear what you have to say, or maybe giving listeners a little bit of context about this.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was writing that chapter and on to our contemporary moment, you know, of course it was like one of those, spaces when, you know, the news of this, you know, alleged and real kind of pandemic or epidemic of trans and queer youth suicides was happening, right? So it started at that moment. And something that I was attempting to pay attention to was, of course, the everydayness of the phenomenon, right? And both of suicide and suicidality, probably more powerfully. And again, not to aestheticize what people are choosing or not choosing to do, or even what choice means in that instance, right? So I'm trying to put the very idea of choice under duress, under question, right? Throwing that into jeopardy, while also, you know, attempting to pay close attention to, like, for example, I do a reading of this young person named Seth Walsh, their suicide note, and their family, like, put out the suicide note into this whole video. And so they wanted lots of people to see it, but does that allow us to see it? I don't know. But they, you know, are someone that took their own life, right? Were forced to take their own life, right? I call suicide murder by other means, because I think it is, because of the constant harassment that they faced at school, that was condoned by the school administration, right? This is their story. It's many of our own stories, right? I was kicked out of school at 14 for a similar situation. And so, you know, they left this suicide note that was so, I don't know, catastrophically beautiful, so eloquent, and so theoretically engaging that it felt like, you know, to leave that out is, again, a kind of second order displacement that hides the very real violence that they were facing, right? So to turn it into a singularly tragic story where they're like a young person that was forced to kill themselves, like, yes, that's part of the story, but they were also theorizing the torment that they were experiencing. So how do we hold both of those together? You know, and that's one of the questions. And I read this against people that are incarcerated that have also attempted to take their own lives, and the ways in which they're punished for attempting to do that, right? Because we always think, or we oftentimes think, that, you know, the kind of most brutal form of state power is death, but there might be something on the other side of that, and that's forced life, which is a hard thing to think about, right? What is it like? What forms of life are more unlivable than death, right? That's the question that I ask. You know, and people that are, you know, living the slow death of carceral life and solitary confinement know this well, right? That literally is the architecture of forced death, right? And so, you know, trying to hold both of the, so then kind of reading these two scenes or these multiple scenes in relationship with each other, right? So we have the kind of more classical young person that's harassed for being gender nonconforming, or something like that. Those are not words that they use to describe themselves, as far as I know. But, you know, forced to death, and then other people that are forced to live, right? And so it's these really, I don't know, intense poles. And so I'm trying to think about how they're working in tandem with each other. And at the same time, right, I'm also interested in cases like Ashley Diamond, who was at the time of writing this, an incarcerated Black trans woman in Georgia. She was also put in solitary confinement. She's out right now. There's ways to support her. You can look it up online and please support her life on the outside. In, you know, she was held in solitary confinement, but she, along with other prisoners, made videos and smuggled them out, right? Kind of chronicling the harassment and the terror that they were living. And for me, it felt important to kind of hold that again with all these other scenes, right? Because even in the spaces of impossibility, people are always finding ways to resist and fight back, right? And so I understand her not, you know, not as simply a kind of, you know, testament to the brutality, but indeed she's a theorist and she's a filmmaker. So what if she's read in those ways as opposed to an example, which is what people oftentimes do, right? People just become examples. You know, because it opens up yet another door for us to think about the complexities of the scene. And I'm emphatic in the beginning of this chapter that I want us to figure out ways to keep each other alive, right? So that's my place of departure. So it's not a kind of, you know, celebration of self-negation. Like, I'm clear about that. But nonetheless, you know, I think that we need more thinking, more theorization, not simply to aestheticize these things, but indeed to end them. Like, what is the world? What ends of the world are necessary so that young people or any people, you know, are not forced towards this end?
Throughout the book, you bring up points about narrative. And I was struck by this as well in what you were saying a few moments ago of even, you know, thinking about this book as a point of departure and thinking about, okay, you know, what comes after it. But in the book you write about, you know, how to narrativize acts of violence, or you describe a murder as an extra diegetic final scene. So I would be curious how the idea of narrative figured into the creation of this work, or even how you see what I heard you call an archive, right, of these acts of violence.
Yeah. So the first chapter, the way that the story goes, I would say, right, is that you know, an act of anti-trans or queer violence or murder will happen. The media narrativizes it as a like singularly bad phobic person, and that person maybe needs to be put away in prison or jail, and that everything else will keep going fine, right? So that's how it starts. And of course, we know that that's not the case. And so, you know, I was interested in thinking about building this archive, but not through kind of traditional data or records collecting, right? Because that's what is now available, and it's problematic for all kinds of reasons. But in its most basic sense, right? What does it mean to turn the kind of terrorizing and agony of people's lives and deaths into data points, right? Into just numbers in an archive. And what do we know if the number of queer people murdered this year goes from like 73 to 74 or 78, like, again, how does that reproduce a kind of second order act of violence, erasing the specificity and that specificity's generalization under like the kind of fantasy of the numerical reality, right? So if we can't go that route, then what other routes could we go? You know, and I think that this is an archive as much as it is a kind of counter archive that places the idea of the archive into jeopardy itself, right? Because it's incomplete, it's partial, it's falling to pieces, it's assembled momentarily by me, and somebody else would assemble it very differently. A lot of it's just almost by chance. And so, you know, it's there hopefully long enough to hold together so that it can build out some form of, you know, knowledge or collective understanding to get us somewhere different. But I don't think it has a kind of durability and shouldn't have a durability beyond that. Like, I'm not interested in like a, you know, an archiving anti trans and queer hate project. Like, that's not what I'm interested in. Again, I think because you know, I'm so interested in, you know, as we were talking about at the beginning, I don't show any pictures that are, you know, violent per se, or that are, you know, pictures of horrible things, but sometimes I do narrativize something, right? Because again, this project or this question of looking and looking away. And so, you know, how I do that feels really important to me. And again, it could be incredibly failed. You know, there's all kinds of questions I have around it, but, you know, I attempt to write and to narrativize these really, you know, unthinkable scenes of violence with as much, again, care and precision as I can. While also paying attention to the specificity, which seems really important to me because, you know, there is a kind of continuity in many of these scenes that is lost if we just, you know, look towards the numbers.
Yeah, I was, I don't know, building on your wonderful response there, I'm thinking a lot about how the narratives that you do provide the readers with do really seem to speak to the tension that you seem to be, I don't know, sitting with, struggling with, sort of without a concrete conclusion between the individual and the system, if I'm reading this correctly.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, for example, in the case of Tawana Johnson and other scenes of police brutality, there are individual police officers that did really awful things and must be held to account. What that looks like, I don't know. But nonetheless, if we stop there or if we hyperfixate on that, then that exonerates the entirety of the system that, again, not only allows this but mandates it, right? And so it's that kind of shuttling, I would say, between, you know, the individuals that are, you know, doing these really or enacting these really awful forms of abuse and harm and sometimes murder, and the systems that support them.
I noticed just a few times throughout the book the use of the word wake. And as well, I am a, I don't know, unapologetic footnote reader and note reader. And so I did also notice the citation for Christina Sharpe's In the Wake on Blackness and Being. So the introduction begins with the description of Martha P. Johnson's body in the Hudson River. You began the book by writing, "The soft blue-black wake rhythmically laps at the rocky shore, gravity's reminder of trans queer endurance on the edge of a city at the end of the world." I was wondering if you thought about, or how you might see wake as a theme throughout this book, or even, you know, if you want to say echoes or something else like that. But just the idea of wake really came through powerfully for me in bits throughout.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I'm deeply thankful for her amazing work, right? And so shout out, definitely. And, you know, in the kind of larger constellation of particularly Black feminists that have been thinking with the question of water and for a long time, right? Of course, tied to the Middle Passage, but much beyond that as well. In the ways that, you know, there's something about the space. There I'm thinking about the piers in New York City, the piers and the water's edge where Marsha P. Johnson's body was found. And of course, where lots of trans and queer of color life was lived until the hypergentrification of the last 15, 20 years of New York City. And so there's something about that space in particular, the piers, the kind of ruins of the piers into the hyper gentrification of the condos that we have now, that feels incredibly sacred, haunted. You know, there's something about the spatiality of it that I wanted to attempt to encapsulate, right? Because it again kind of swings between both a scene of, you know, horrific violence, right? The possible, probable murder of Marsha P. Johnson. And so much, you know, trans and queer sex and celebration and community and liveliness. And, you know, Sylvia was living unhoused on, you know, towards the end of her life. you know, in that same area as well. And so it's like, how do we hold the messiness and the kind of, you know, they're not even contradictions, but the incommensurabilities of these spaces together, right? While not attempting to resolve any of it because it's unresolvable.
Something I realize I touched on it briefly earlier, but I want to come back to it. A point that you make a number of times throughout the book is thinking race and gender together. And it comes up not just in the instances of violence that you show, you know, for example, the Pulse shooting or, you know, just other examples throughout the book. But also in terms of the theory where you ground yourself. And so I was hoping you could maybe say a little bit about, about that, just because I was really, excited, I guess, just to see a really thoughtful consideration, particularly when you're thinking about an atmosphere of violence, right? About something that is porous and broad and nonspecific in so many ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the anti-trans and queer violence is always racialized, right? It always lives and has its life within the scenes of queer settler colonialism and that colonialism's ongoingness, right? And so, you know, and it's not only beginning there, but it's staying there, right? So we can have no analysis, we can have no whatever the thing is that people call trans studies without an ongoing and deep reckoning with an engagement with, you know, colonialism, with the instantiation and that instantiation's ongoingness of chattel slavery, right? Those are all the things that are, to me, actually foregrounded, right? And then my archive, in a certain sense, is trans and queer people, most of whom are Black and Latinx, I guess. It's not exactly the words that they would use to describe themselves, and I always try to be specific. But, you know, and so to me, you know, that's the kind of political world that I come from, the, you know, intellectual genealogies that I understand myself within, you know, and that have formed me and continue to form me. And also the conversations that are the most, you know, insurgent, right? That are pushing collective thought in the most radical, nuanced, and necessary ways, right? And so that's where I kind of find my grounding or something like that, and my continued sources of instigation, and the people that I like to think with. Yeah. And so I think that, you know, this is not, the project could not be done without all that collective thought.
I was to come back as my last question about this really incredible book, and again, perhaps this is my anthropological background coming through, but again, this tension between the general and the specific, but in particularly, for example, you note in the Pulse shooting, right, that it shifts to become an act of violence against all Americans. And when you discuss instances of police violence, it's, you know, who are these people acting for? You know, whose names are they doing this of? And I would be curious to hear your thoughts a little more about that broadening, right? Not just the specificities of these instances, but sort of what is, and whose name is this happening, or who is claiming to be hurt here?
Yeah, I mean, the Pulse shooting, the scene itself, which is horrific, and the subsequent narrativization, which is again extending that initial scene of harm to our present day, right? Because for people that don't know, essentially what happened is that someone goes into the bar and shoots a bunch of people, in its first narrativized or reported as an anti trans or queer hate crime, right? It's at a gay bar, The Pulse. But then later on, it gets kind of recuperated through, you know, white nationalist understandings of the United States, that the shooter was not acting because it was a quote unquote gay bar, but was a, you know, a terrorist attack on quote unquote all Americans, right? Which of course means straight, white, Christian Americans. And that was really interesting to me to follow the kind of media coverage and the court cases that came after it, right? And how that was switched around, right? How the hyper-specificity that I think cannot be deracinated from that case, right? That it was almost exclusively trans and queer people of color that were murdered and shot and harmed in other ways. Right, that specificity just becomes like obliterated under a generalization of quote unquote Americanness, right? And who does that serve, right? To go back to your question, of course, we know that serves, you know, the settler state of the United States. Right, so there is no atmosphere of anti-trans and queer violence. There are just, you know, terrorists attempting to attack, you know, the otherwise peaceful United States, right? That's how the story gets re-narrativized. So it's, you know, tied up in all forms of Islamophobia and, you know, other forms of racist antagonisms in the court, in the case, and then what happens after it. So, you know, we have that. And what's interesting, you know, so we have that, the kind of, as you said, the specific to the hyper generalized, right, to erase the specificity. And then we have the other move. You know, I'm always thinking about my theorization of state power is actually always built through contradictions, right? I think the state works most vividly and most violently through forms of simultaneous exclusion and inclusion, right? That's one of the arguments of the book, right? Again, we can think about the suicide. It's not just about pushing people out. It's about pushing people out, then pulling them back in so you continue to terrorize them, right? Because that's just not enough, right? Death is not enough. And so I think that, you know, the state is always working in these you know, not just dualistic, but like kind of multifaceted, like a web or something like that. And so, you know, in instances of police violence, right, of course, it's not the generalized attack on Black, Indigenous, and Latinx people, right? It's just that specific person, right? So it's the kind of going from the general to the hyper-specific when it wants to, and then the specific to the hyper-general when it also wants to, right? And these are, you know, both in terms of policy and the media and the kind of narrativization, the way in which it functions and circulates in popular culture, right? And also just to, this seems important to clarify, when I'm thinking about the state, also the way that I think about the state, you know, it's not a kind of hyper rigid abstraction that exists outside of the social that would allow us to blame some external force. I mean, it does have a bunch of really forceful organizing principles like the police, but for me, it's the kind of collective projection of the social itself, right? You know, as we know, for example, the vast majority of policing that happens is not done by the actual police, right? You deputize everybody. And the state works in a similar way, right? It's not just the kind of state bureaucrats or the quote unquote government, you know, doing whatever violence they're doing, wherever. It's the way in which we also all internalize and reproduce those logics, right? And, you know, continue the kind of system of hyper-surveillance and punishment any and everywhere.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and speaking with me about atmospheres of violence. Before we close our conversation, would you like to let listeners know about other projects you might be working on, as well as where they might be able to find your work?
Sure. Thank you so much. These are really excellent questions, and I love just talking with people and figuring it out together. Yeah, so I'm working on this book right now. I don't know when it will be out. Hopefully, I would say soon, but that's a lie. At some point on trans and queer and gender nonconforming people and armed leftist groups in the 1970s and 80s. So that's really exciting. And I'm, you know, deep in the research and the thinking around that and questions specifically of like non-sovereignty is what I'm trying to theorize in that. So that you know, look for that. You can find me on Twitter when I'm not banned. I don't even know what my name is on there, but you can find it. Unfortunately, I'm easy to find. Thanks so much for spending this time with me.
Thanks. And for listeners, I'll add links to all of that in the show notes as well. So, thank you so much.